The views and comments expressed on Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other
things.
Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everyone. At least it is still morning here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Great to be with you. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in to one of our favorite Space Show guests. I'll introduce our friend again in just a moment. But first, a couple of announcements. For those of you who would like to talk to Dr. B, it is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Please wait, and we will bring you up on air and into the mix as soon as possible. Again, 1-866-687-7223. For those of you listening at work or otherwise not able to use the phones for whatever reason, email is welcome, and that is Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. So are your blog posts. So just go over to thespaceshow.com website, look for this program on the right side menu. It should be under upcoming show, should be the top show, and open up the show for today and scroll down to where the comments are. And you can post your comments or questions for Dr. Brandenburg right there, and I will immediately get a copy and can read them on air. So that's how you can stay in touch with us, by phone, by email, and by blog post. Do go to our website, thespaceshow.com. Check out our comprehensive and detailed website newsletter. It does get updated Sunday afternoon after the Sunday Space Show program. And if you scroll down on the website newsletter, you will see all of the upcoming shows planned so far, and we're booking into August and September right now. So if you have any questions about any of that, guest recommendations or anything of that nature, please do let me hear from you. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily and very quickly download these shows. There's also a menu in the upper left-hand corner, so check it out. There are new links and things of interest for you. There are the Listen Live instructions. If you want to share that with somebody, that's how you listen to our show on the Internet for a live program. And, of course, under the support menu is our LogoWare store with lots of new items, all with our new logo on it. So do check it out if you're interested in Space Show hats or T-shirts or dog clothing or something of that nature, coffee mugs. They're all there, again, with our new email, with our new logo there. We are trademarked and copyrighted, but all of you can download our shows or pass them along with the URL if that works out better for you. We're starting a new file-saving service. We're going to reduce our file size by 50%. So a typical Space Show program is going to be approximately 9 or 10 megabytes right now. If you have any problems listening to any of the shows starting this week, do let me hear from you, because we are going into a different system, and we need to hear from you if you're experiencing any difficulties, and that includes on the podcast as well. Speaking of the podcast, Gigadial does it for us, and you can find us in iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any questions or issues, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors, and we thank them very much. You can see their banner ads going across our homepage. But for today, the first segment of our program has two sponsors. So AIAA is a sponsor. That is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. This is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have over 30,000 individual members, And they come from 88 countries, and they have about 95 corporate members. They shape the future of aerospace every day. They advance the state of aerospace science and technology, increase the knowledge of the universe, and bring the world closer together. For those of you that are going to be at Space 2016 in Long Beach early next month, do let me know. I'll be there. I look forward to meeting you. Get more information at their website, AIAA.org. And then Celestis is a sponsor, and remember, they are the premier space memorial service. So they have interesting spots that they like me to read. So this one is called Celestis in Pop Culture. Celestis is widely known for their memorial spaceflight services. As a result, they've often been featured in popular culture. Major media outlets around the world covered the first Celestis memorial spaceflight in 1997, which included Timothy Leary and Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. The New Yorker magazine published a cartoon about the launch. The flight was recorded in the Guinness Book of Records and was even added to the popular board game Trivial Pursuit. Noted personalities from U.S. Senator John Glenn to actress Susan Sarandon have been recommended, and Celestis has been recommended by many to friends and constituents alike. Actors including Jonathan Frakes, Patrick Stewart, and Tom Hanks have announced their own interest in a space funeral. Star Trek's James Doohan and Gene and Majel Roddenberry will fly on a Celestis deep space mission. And Celestis has been featured in movies, popular music, and the game show. To tell the truth, and I am a customer of Celestis. I absolutely love the company, the people that work for it. They have successfully flown the remains of my mom and two of my dogs to both suborbital and orbital space. And they're wonderful people to do business with. And, you know, one would think it's weird to promote a funeral service. But it's not as if it's a funeral service. It's a real honor and a really great deal to commemorate one's life by doing this, and Celestis makes that really cool. So if you have someone you'd like to honor in their life or something like that, that's cool. You don't really need their ashes. For my dogs, I only had ashes for one of my dogs, so I was able to send up some of the Samoyed's fur because I kept their fur because you can weave sweaters and fabric out of it. It's that type of thing. It's kind of like lamb's wool. And a Samoyan, also a Husky, they have fur, not hair, and it makes really nicely into weaving, and there's a lot of people that do this on the internet. And so I was able to send up a couple of strands of their fur to mix in with my mother's ashes. So again, you could probably use a piece of a fingernail or something like that, or hair, if you don't believe in cremation. So, cool service, and I can't recommend them anymore. And that brings me to our guest today, who is Dr. John Brandenburg. We can ask him if he's planning a space funeral when he answers the phone, and we'll see what he thinks about that. But Doc Brandenburg, who is a very often guest on the space show, and he goes way back to the beginning of the space show with me, is a great friend, is an American theoretical plasma physicist, so he's the real McCoy, and he was born in Rochester, Minnesota, under the care of the Mayo Clinic, which is why he's so special. And then he grew up in Medford, Oregon. He obtained his BA in physics with a math minor from Southern Oregon University in 1975 and got his MS in 1977 and PhD in theoretical plasma physics in 1981 at a little-known school that we didn't even know issued PhDs. That's the University of California at Davis. So, John, welcome back to the show. Are you planning a space burial when you pass on?
Not just yet, Dave. I still got a few things to take care of.
Well,
on the planet.
I think you should be honored by being sent into space with a big chemical rocket roaring underneath. And
well, I'd like my ashes to be deposited on Mars.
Well, maybe
a little bit more ambitious than low Earth orbit.
Well, you're a young man, so maybe by the time your time comes, that type of flight will be both affordable and I don't know if it would be routine, but it might be doable.
One thing that concerns me is packages of ashes up there. They're in Leo, low Earth orbit, so they're going to decay.
Well, that's what they want. They want it to.
It's a space junk.
Yeah, so it re-enters the Earth and burns up, and they say it becomes, and you become part of the cosmos again.
Really,
cool.
Now I've heard that. Now I would always wondered about that. So, yeah, maybe sign me up.
They do, I don't have the details on it, but they do actually have a planned Mars mission for some people. And I think if you went to their website, you could probably...
Well, see, I intend to go up and stand on Mars in a spacesuit someday. So maybe I can. I can make funeral arrangements on Mars itself at the colony.
Well, you know, and if you go up soon, you probably will have to, because you probably aren't coming back. The question will be, can you get there?
40% gravity, you'll probably live longer on Mars.
Well, can you get there in good enough condition to stand up when you get there?
Well, that's what I'm working on, Dave. It's good that you mentioned that, because the whole goal of my enterprise of life right now is to, well, solve the energy crisis, energy climate crisis. That's one goal. But the other goal is to get humanity on Mars with two-way travel. One way will suffice to begin with, because as anyone who studies the problem knows, landing on the surface of Mars is actually the easiest part of a human Mars mission. It's coming back that is the really dangerous part. You basically have to put an Atlas missile, like John Glenn had, with like a three-person capsule on top, to get up into low Mars orbit and rendezvous with a mothership to come home. So that is a non-trivial exercise, particularly because the Mars environment is a giant static electricity machine. They're now picking up a lot of radio noise during the perihelion part of Mars, where Mars is closest to the sun in its orbit, and there's a lot of dust devils, and they think they're getting a lot of static electricity with static discharges generating in the dust devils. In fact, at night they might glow. That would be really fun to see. But in any case, getting to Mars fast and cheap is the big goal now. One of my students asked me if we could send people to Mars now, and I said, sure, if we just shrink them to the size of Barbie dolls. So we can land one-ton things on Mars now, like the rovers. One-ton rover, radio isotope powered, no problem. But landing a person there, and of course, we'd like to be able to bring them back at some point, that's a much more expensive and dangerous proposition. So what we're looking for is breakthrough propulsion. I worked on both chemical propulsion, vortex engines at Orbital Technologies. We were working on, making them very efficient. That finally worked. But also my primary work as a plasma physicist has been on electric propulsion, developing, electric thrusters. Mine uses microwaves and electrodeless microwave discharge to heat water vapor to blue-white-hot temperatures, and then shoot it out of a nozzle. That's one way to get to Mars. You can do it with solar power. But beyond that, the ultimate electric propulsion is to not just move hot gas with electricity as rocket exhaust, but to move space-time itself, the substance of space. And we know from quantum mechanics that space-time, what we call space-time, is thick with virtual particles. Schrodinger's cat, every other thing you could imagine exists momentarily in the vacuum. And the vacuum can be described as a plasma of virtual particles. Virtual meaning they appear due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and then disappear. So how do we work with this fabric of space-time, which is, in typical quantum mechanics, we know is there. We see its indirect effects, called Casimir effect. We, put two plates together. They have a force which starts forcing them together, the force of electromagnetic waves in the vacuum. But typical of quantum mechanical mysteries, you can't directly measure this. You can't get a direct measurement of this effect. And in fact, if we could see it, literally, we would all be vaporized by it because we're surrounded with this field of energy that has to be there because of quantum mechanics. And guess who found out that this existed? It was Albert Einstein.
What is the effect? Say again the effect that you're talking about.
The effect is that Heisenberg uncertainty principle is working even in where there is nothing there. It means that particles can pop out of existence, out of non-existence into existence, and then pop back into non-existence again. It's like the observer is a pitcher in a baseball game, and he's got people on every base, and they're always trying to steal bases. So he looks around, and they get back on their base again. That's a baseball analogy to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You got somebody trying to steal another base all the time. They won't stay on their base.
But in Star Trek, they solved that with the transporter, right? They
teleportation, just stick on the subject of just space-time itself.
Well, they had a scientific rationale for how the transporter would work against the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
I must have missed that episode. It must have been Next Generation, right?
I don't know. I think it was in the basic Star Trek. I don't remember what it was. It would be a simple Google.
I remember watching that as a little kid, and we're going to the moon at the same time, and the future looked incredibly bright.
Absolutely.
What part of my role in life is to try and restore that bright vision of the future to modern day kids?
Well, they had a rationale for how the transporter would work despite the Heisenberg principle. I don't remember what it was, but I don't have time to Google it while listening, talking to you. But it's a simple Google search, I bet, to see what their rationale was.
Well,
how they defeated it.
Well, according to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, I am actually sitting in a cafe in Los Angeles at a Starbucks having a cafe latte grande right now. But it has very little probability. So the moment anyone goes and looks for me there, I'm back here in Madison, Wisconsin. So you could sort of say that, yes, a teleportation, nature does teleportation all the time. Now, but here is the thing, is that the vacuum is full of all of this activity and all these virtual particles. And one of the most embarrassing calculations in physics is when they calculate the mass density of what the vacuum should be because of E equals MC squared. All of that energy in there should give a mass. And by the way, Einstein proved to Max Planck, the originator of quantum mechanics, that the zero point energy, what's called zero point fluctuation, had to be there. It had to exist. So you do a calculation, for instance, the density of water is 1 gram per cc. The density of the air in the room around us is 1 milligram per cc. It's 1,000th the density of water. But supposedly the density of the vacuum, the mass density, E equals MC squared, is like 10 to the 96 grams per cc. It's even it's much denser than lead or uranium. It is a ridiculous number. So one of the great puzzles of physics is to get rid of that mass density, somehow that is canceled. So the vacuum, nothingness, Dave, is actually a very complicated place in the standard model of physics that we all believe. This is the same model that gives us quantum mechanics, electromagnetism, you know, what's interesting about the standard model of physics, you know, it has quarks in it, it has the W and Z bosons, which carry the weak force of nature, which does radioactive decay. It carries the gluons and what are called pions, which carry the strong force that holds the nucleus together, despite the fact that everything is positively charged that wants to blow apart. The strong force holds everything together with these particles called pions. And the weak force then is mediated by particles called W and Z, which are much heavier with much shorter range. They bring the weak force, that's the radium watch dial glowing. The strong force is the sun, you know, or the stars, or a hydrogen bomb, for example. So the standard model has electromagnetism, the strong and the weak force. And the weak force is partly unified now with electromagnetism. But what's interesting is gravity is not included in the standard model. So what I have been working on is to try to include gravity in the standard model of physics to achieve that unification, which Einstein worked on trying to unify gravity and electromagnetism. So I've been working now for really 40 years as a professional trying to do that. I published a lot of work. It's called the GEM theory, and now it's called GEMS, which means GEM super unification.
Are you making progress in getting it into the
standard
model?
I've made enormous progress. That's, you know, if you, just like Einstein, you know, Einstein is my inspiration. He was in a patent office working away. Most people don't realize that he published his three articles that got him the Nobel Prize, basically, while working in a patent office. And nothing happened for 2 years. I mean, the real fan he had was Max Planck, the inventor of quantum mechanics.
Right.
And so nothing happened initially once he published these articles. So he just kept working in his patent office. You know, I teach physics, astronomy, and mathematics at a local college here part-time, and, you know, other places I teach physics and calculus at ITT Tech. And so it's better than a patent office, but I'm sort of in the same situation. But what is nice about working in a patent office, you don't have the chairman of the department or the dean bothering you all the time, saying, why aren't you getting some grant money or something like that. So you have great freedom to work when you're just a part-time physics professor, physics and astronomy professor. So what's nice is that I have been working on this. I've been funded very briefly by the government, by DARPA, because they got interested in my work, and they had some money to support me. But I've been working on this. My first publication on this was in 1987. And so basically, if you look at Einstein's original idea, Einstein says, okay, there's gravity and electromagnetism. They both have infinite range. We now have the field equations for them, Maxwell's equations and his own general theory of relativity. And he becomes fixated on the idea that these can be unified. This person has already invented the laser. I mean, he did the theoretical backing for the laser. He basically boosted the early development of quantum mechanics. He showed it was real. He did a lot of work on quantum mechanics, even though he didn't like it. He kept saying God doesn't play dice with the universe, and he got in a debate with Niels Bohr, the inventor of the Bohr atom,
right?
Founder of quantum mechanics, the Copenhagen School of quantum mechanics, and he's in a debate at some big scientific meeting with Niels Bohr, and Einstein keeps saying God doesn't play dice with the universe, and Bohr finally told him, he said, quit telling God what to do.
You can hear that debate. It's on YouTube.
Fabulous.
They've got the tapes of it on YouTube. So it listens if you've never done it.
The quantum mechanics people were actually really worried that Einstein was going to show that they were wrong because he was so smart. They were afraid of him.
Fortunately,
they won the debate and showed that quantum mechanics had to be right. And, in fact, I said in one book I wrote, I said, God may not play dice, but he does own a casino. He does own the casino. And he's aware that gambling is occurring on the premises.
Why is gravity omitted from the standard model? Start there.
It can't be quantized right now. That's the reason. Gravity, the equations of gravity, if you try to make quantized gravity, you get immediately the result that gravity feeds on itself like a feeding frenzy, and you get all sorts of microscopic black holes in the equations that start gobbling each other up, and finally the whole universe collapses. You get a catastrophe when you try to add conventional quantum, when you try and do standard quantum mechanics using the gravitational equations. For instance, if you take Maxwell's equations and apply relativity and quantum mechanics to the equations of electromagnetism, you get a beautiful theory called quantum electrodynamics, which got Feynman the Nobel Prize. Making the E&M field into photons of light, easy to do. Well, not that easy. That's why Feynman got the Nobel Prize. But Feynman figured it out, and you could do that. But if you apply the same techniques that Feynman applied to the equations of gravity, you get a catastrophe. Everything blows up. The universe collapses into one giant black hole. And so people have been, Feynman tried to quantize gravity using his techniques. And he found that using the full Einstein equations, it couldn't be done. And Hawking has tried to do this. The closest, what they do now is they look at certain limits, what's called the Planck scale, where Heisenberg uncertainty principle allows the formation of a mass. A mass pops out of the vacuum, a particle and its antiparticle. And the particles are so heavy that they form black holes immediately. And then the black holes evaporate using Hawking's evaporation of black holes, which is why he is famous. He showed that small black holes would evaporate, explode. And so this is added into the zero-point fluctuation. It's called the Planck scale turbulence. And it basically establishes a pixel size for the universe. Let's say the universe was a giant virtual reality show. This is an idea, a bright, shiny object idea for a lot of geeks who are into computers, that we're all living in a virtual reality show.
Yeah, Elon Musk says that.
Was that?
Elon Musk has talked about that.
Well, then all he's got to do is access the operating system. We can get to Mars with just a keystroke, right?
Yeah, I guess that's a little bit elusive yet still.
Why build these big rockets, Elon? If you really believe we're in a virtual reality, you ought to be able to just make a portal to Mars, you know? But anyway, so as it turns out, the finest minds in physics have tried to quantize gravity. It can't be done given our present understanding. The closest we've come is that Hawking showed that if you make a black hole small enough, it will actually evaporate. It'll explode due to quantum mechanics. So we are stuck with a very well proven standard model of physics using quarks, the W and Z bosons for the weak force, the gluons for the strong force, We have photons for E&M. Everything is quantized. Everything works. We have the Higgs boson. Then we try and add gravity to it. It just quits working. We can only put in gravity, kind of write in gravity to solve some of the problems of the standard model. The standard model has one little problem. It predicts that the mass of the vacuum should be, 10 to the 10th denser than lead. And the Planck thing and some other things involving gravity make that kind of go away, or at least they are able to push it under the rug so it doesn't disturb people. So that is the big problem that we have now in physics. Now, what I have been trying to do is extend the standard model of physics, particularly E&M, with gravity, because they're both long-range forces. The carriers of the law of E&M, the photons, the quantum mechanical photons, they have zero mass. Technically, the gravitons of gravity should also have zero mass. So they have that much in common with electromagnetism. And both of them obey the inverse square law. So it looks like we have a place where the standard model and gravity, think of them as two islands. We have the narrowest part of water between them. We should be able to swim that. It's almost doable. We can almost throw a rock from the island of gravity to the island of the standard model at point E&M, where E&M theory and gravity theory are almost in agreement. Now, one of the things that Einstein also did, he spent 30 years of his life trying to solve this problem. They did say that on his deathbed, he woke up, got out of bed, and talked excitedly to his nurse in German, but his nurse didn't understand German. Then he got back into his bed and went to sleep and never woke up. So who knows? He may have figured it out.
Is that a true story?
That is a true story.
And his nurse, did she speak German?
No, she didn't speak German.
Oh, so she doesn't have a clue with what he said.
She doesn't have a clue what he was talking about. He was speaking excitedly in German. And they say that he then got back into bed, went to sleep, and never woke up. But, so, now, let's suppose Einstein was right, basically. Except, Einstein did not like quantum mechanics. In fact, one of the reasons he probably didn't like quantum mechanics is because it was obvious even to him that you couldn't apply standard quantum mechanics to gravity. So he said, quantum mechanics must be wrong. He's Einstein. He can say that. So my task has been to try and pick up the trail where Einstein left it, only add quantum mechanics. Figure out how to add quantum mechanics to this analysis, to this problem of unifying E&M and gravity. And I have made great progress. I've gotten the gravitation constant, the Newton gravitation constant, big G. You can look it up on the web. Newton-Cavendish constant. I have that derived with a simple formula now to a part per 10,000, which is almost as good as they can measure it. And I also got the proton mass to appear, the mass of hydrogen. Now, the proton mass is very significant because, and Einstein fixated on this later in life also in his theory, when the Big Bang happened, what came out? Hydrogen, which is a heavy charge, a positive charge, a proton, and a light electron circling around it. But when the universe is born, it's a plasma of positive and negative charges, a heavy charge, heavy positive charge, the proton, and a light electron. Why did the universe make hydrogen? I mean, why not vanilla cake with chocolate frosting. Why hydrogen? In fact, I go around at meetings and I said, is anyone interested in hydrogen? And they all say, hydrogen is boring. There's so much of it. They're interested in, you know, quarkonium, things like that, which they make in atomic accelerators. But if you take everything that's been made in all the colliders, the super colliders all around the world, the super particle accelerators, and put it in a box for 10 minutes, everything will turn into hydrogen. It's like hydrogen is the basic stuff. If you, once everything cools off and radiates, decays into neutrinos and things like photons, they get rid of all those things, what is left is hydrogen. So hydrogen is the basic thing that space-time wants to deal with. It's the only two stable isolated particles in the universe. The neutron, as it turns out, will actually blow up in about 8 minutes, like a firecracker, and it turns into hydrogen. It emits a neutrino, and what's left behind after the neutrino goes wherever it wants to go, nothing can stop it, is hydrogen, a proton and an electron. So Einstein became fixated on this. He said, the universe has two long-range forces, gravity and NM, and it likes hydrogen. And that's basically where he was when he arrived on his deathbed and may have had this last final insight, and maybe in a slightly delirious state, as if, you know, if you're in a fever state, that's the closest thing you can get to taking LSD without actually taking it. So we have this fascinating puzzle. The universe has two long-range forces, a weak one, gravity, and a strong one, electromagnetism, and it likes hydrogen. So I basically focused on that, how to unify E&M and gravity mathematically and physically in a physical model and have a universe that makes hydrogen. Now, the reason you have to include hydrogen is because the proton is the source of all the mass in the universe. The electron is basically the source of all the electrical activity. Because the proton is heavy and doesn't like to move, the electron races around and makes electricity. So, boom, the Big Bang. I love the Big Bang as a science fiction writer, by the way, so that one of my characters, Pamela Monroe, can say, ask her friend Cassandra Chen, if the universe began violently, will it end violently? It began with a big explosion. I like it. I like it already. So Einstein focused on these two field equations that both obeyed the inverse square law and both made waves. We know there's gravity waves now. We've just detected them. People think that's a great triumph of physics, and it is, but the theory that produced it is 100 years old. We haven't made any progress, basically, on gravity. But we've made gravity waves. We now have detected gravity waves from colliding black holes, and we know the universe is made of hydrogen, and we also know that they're E&M waves. We use them all the time. So we have all these pieces on the table. Now, as it turns out, Einstein helped. There was another area of science that Einstein didn't like. He didn't like quantum mechanics, but he helped prove that it was correct with his initial publications. There was another theory out there that he didn't like, but he helped it to get published. This was the work of Kaluza and Klein, which said there was a hidden dimension in the universe. The hidden dimension, as it turns out, if you add that to the same mathematics, there's a type of mathematics developed by a guy named David Hilbert. You'd have liked him, Dave. This guy was so smart, he almost beat Einstein to the punch on developing the equations for general relativity. He was just absolutely brilliant. He was, in fact, he was much better at math than Einstein, and said so. But Einstein, it was Einstein's theory, so Hilbert basically let him take credit for it. Hilbert said that you could find, if you did space-time was like a big block of rubber, and it wants to relax. If you twist the block of rubber or squeeze it or push it around, it wants to rebound back to its regular shape. Or if you're squishing it, it likes to relax internally, so it distributes all the stress. So you can actually write equations for a block of rubber. Now imagine that space-time is like a block of rubber. This was Hilbert's great advance. If you write the equations for a minimum energy state, minimum stress, in a block of rubber that's being pushed and distorted, you pretend that that is space-time, Einstein's equations for general relativity fall out. Now, Kaluza and Klein found that if you add a fifth dimension, so not only do you have regular space-time, but you have this hidden dimension, and you do the same relaxation, say everything wants to relax to a minimum energy, everything is economical, the universe is built on a budget. Let's have a minimum cost structure. When you do that, not only do the equations of Einstein's general relativity fall out like before, but because of the presence of the fifth dimension, which is hidden, invisible, Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism fall out also. It's one of the most magnificent pieces of mathematics in existence. And they fall in correctly so that the mass of electromagnetic energy is the source for gravity. And the forces of E&M and gravity on a particle are reproduced properly. It's two miracles. So Einstein looks at this and he says, what do you mean there's a hidden dimension? I don't like it. So he sent it back to this guy, but the guy, then he thought about it, and he thought, well, you know, it reproduces my equations of general relativity and the equations of Maxwell's equations from one mathematical procedure. There must be something to it. So Einstein writes this guy back, Kaluza, and says, send me your article again. And what Einstein would do, and he did this for Schrodinger, people would send him stuff that couldn't get into journals, and Einstein would send it to the journal with a note saying, I like this, publish it.
And they published.
And who's going to argue with Einstein?
So they published it.
So they published it. I mean, Niels Bohr was the only guy with the huevos to argue with Einstein, and he won. Nobody else wanted to argue with Einstein. So if Einstein said, this should be published in your journal, it would get published. So the Kaluza-Klein theory unifies gravity and electromagnetism mathematically, but it has this hidden dimension in it, which Einstein didn't like, and even Kaluza and Klein. Klein added to the theory, he added the hidden part. Somebody asked, the editor said, well, where is this fifth dimension? Where can I find it? And Klein wrote a new article saying, Kaluza's right, the dimension's hidden, it's invisible. It's like a blue unicorn. It explains everything, but you can't see it. So the mathematical equations of E&M and gravity were unified with this hidden dimension in this Kaluza-Klein theory, and Einstein got it published, even though he said, I don't like it. I don't like this hidden dimension business. So, this was the foundation of string theory, because string theory is based on having more than four dimensions. The fifth dimension of Kaluza and Klein, I mean, the string theory people said, well, if you add one fifth dimension to these equations and you get good things, you get Maxwell's equations and the equations of electromagnetism and the equations of gravity for one thing, then if we add 11 more dimensions, it must be better, right? So,
Is this a good pause place for our
break? This is a good pause place, yes.
Okay. Before I pause, I have two advanced emails from listeners that came in that have nothing to do with what you're talking about. So I think you can dispense of them before we go to the break very, very quickly.
Okay, very good.
Okay, so Tim Weaver in Huntsville says he wants an update on the hybrid fission-fusion reactor, and would you be willing to devote an episode on the space show discussing it? So, Tim, I would have to be the one willing to devote an episode to discussing it.
Well, it's the solution to the climate energy crisis.
Is there anything of substance in a discussion for a space show program, or is it all conjecture and BS?
Oh, no. This is absolutely solid physics. You can go to websites.
Right, but there is no hybrid fission-fusion reactor.
No, they haven't built one yet, but they could build one. The only problem is it would require that the fusion people at the Department of Energy and the fission people who split atoms, split uranium for power, and people who combine hydrogen for power, to get together and talk, and they don't like each other. They actually have different wings of the building. I talked to a guy at Department of Energy. He said they never talk.
So this would be a purely hypothetical discussion?
No, well, it is. No one has done it yet, but it can be done. The Russians are thinking of building one because you can make fusion neutrons. Fusion is good for making neutrons right now. We can't make power, but we can make a lot of neutrons. And neutrons are, of course, what run a nuclear reactor. Also, you can take nuclear waste and irradiate it with the neutrons from fusion and transmute the radioactive waste into much shorter-lived radioactive stuff so it will be safe in 50 years rather than 10,000. So it can solve the nuclear waste problem.
Why not use thorium?
To answer this question, you must answer the question of why is the human race so bad? Why has it got this rascally character? It turns out the reason we don't use thorium in reactors, even though it is as abundant as lead, is because you can't make good nuclear weapons.
Well, I know that, but that's why they don't. You want to make nuclear power plants, partially why, because it makes
plutonium for your nuclear weapons program.
Right, so why? So
thorium doesn't make plutonium.
So that should rationally be why you would want to, you know, go down
the
thorium.
Oh, irrationally, yes. And India has big deposits of thorium, and they are running thorium reactors now.
And they work just fine?
Oh, they work just great. In fact, the radioactive waste from thorium is much shorter lived than the radioactive waste from uranium.
So it
helps solve the nuclear waste problem.
And so in answer to Tim's question, is this worth a topic on the space show?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
We all want to solve the energy problem, and we want to solve without going back and living in caves and giving up fire, which some environmentalists have suggested.
And some politicians,
yes.
I thought the pipeline would solve the energy problem.
Well, yes. Temporarily.
Okay. All right, here's the next question. This comes from someone named Initial A, and the last name is, I guess, Fate, F-E-I-T, or Fight. And he says, can the GEM theory explain the workings of M-drive?
M-drive, which I presume they mean the workings of the experiment they have running in Houston.
Well, and it's being run in other countries.
Yes, the fact that they're firing microwaves into a box.
Right, into a cone.
Into a cone, kind of a traffic cone.
Right.
And they're getting thrust out of it.
Correct.
According to conventional electromagnetism, that should not be happening at all.
Yeah, you're violating conservation of
energy. Yes, the GEM theory does explain that because basically, and we can go into that after the break.
Okay.
The whole GEM theory that I've been developing is for really practical things. I'm talking about, you know, hidden dimensions and things like that. Actually, I want to go to Mars.
You belong there, let me tell you. You want to
I'd like to go to Mars, and the GEM theory can get me there in a month.
And you want to go explore where the nuclear explosions took place to confirm it, right?
Well, that's right. And, in fact, I just got a paper accepted at the space conference.
Which space conference?
In Long Beach.
Oh, so you're going to be there?
I'm going to be there.
Oh, my God, we're going to get together again.
Absolutely.
I can't wait.
No, and I wrote them in a long abstract saying
here's evidence
for nuclear weapons signature on Mars.
Hey, wait a minute. What day are you talking? God, please.
Should be Thursday.
Oh, crap. I'm going down with listener John Hunt. I wish he were listening to this show, but he probably is at work. And we're going back to Cal State Fullerton, to Dr. Jim Woodward's office, who I know very well,
yes,
to further explore
scholar and a gentleman
Mach thrusters and his work on the Woodward effect for Mach thrusters.
Which is related, apparently, to the same M-drive, the QV thruster in Houston.
Well, John is coming with me, so that someone other than me who will know physics and can actually talk to Jim and Heidi and understand what's going on and then help explain it to Space Show listeners. I think we're there all day Thursday or something.
I
would bring you with me if you were free.
Be fine. Unfortunately, I am also a part-time professor at a college.
What difference does that
make? Physics and astronomy and math, and I have to go in there, present my papers, and then hop on an airplane and come back so I don't miss any class.
Well, wait a minute. But if you're going to be there anyway, and maybe my deal is on Wednesday instead of Thursday. And I'm trying to see if I can find
I'll be there Thursday morning.
Yeah, but you're going to be talking Thursday, right?
Right.
Yeah, so you probably can't go down to Long Beach with us, because I think our appointment is Thursday at about 11:30 in the morning, and we're going to drive down there. Yeah, it is too bad. Guys, that would be wonderful.
You know, I have a teaching schedule, and I have to kind of work this trip in around it.
Can you change your speaking schedule at AIAA?
No, right. I have to basically, you know, in fact, they've already changed it once. And so I'm not going to ask them to change it again. So.
Really? I wonder, they have a teaching schedule, so that's what we could work out with Heidi Fern
and Jim,
because we have to comply with his teaching schedule, too, at Cal State.
I have to teach at 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday, so I have to get back to Madison to teach.
God, it would be fabulous for you to go into Woodward's lab with us.
I would love to do that. Great work. I haven't done much GEM theory. Is mostly a theory of the vacuum, empty space, where you except, you know, you can have electromagnetic radiation and gravity in empty space, and the two can change each other. And that's the QV thruster down at Houston.
Yeah.
It's empty. It's got nothing in it. So that's perfect for the GEM theory. But Woodward's thing is, you know, basically solid dielectric and metal, and that's much more complicated for me to analyze with this theory of mine. Basically, the GEM theory says, and this is, by the way, the work of Sakharov. What I've done is I've combined the work of Andrei Sakharov, who invented the Russian hydrogen bomb, which runs on radiation pressure, by the way. We know there's a people, by the way, think that electromagnetism is just magnetism and electricity. It is. Those are the two forces. I mean, magnetism holds your bills to your refrigerator door. Static electricity is pulling stuff out of the dryer in the middle of winter, and it's all full of, static electricity, and all of the fibers on your sweater stand up on end. That's electric force, and then the magnetic force holding your bills to the refrigerator door, that's magnetic force. There's a third force of E&M, and that's radiation pressure, where you can shine a light on something in a vacuum, and it will feel a force, because the light carries momentum and energy. And this is how the hydrogen bomb works. This used to be classified, by the way. It's now unclassified. They basically have a watermelon-shaped cavity, and they put an atomic bomb at one end, and they put a ball of hydrogen isotopes at one end. The atomic bomb goes off, fills the chamber full of blue, white, hot radiation, and it crushes, the radiation pressure crushes the hydrogen into a star. And that's how a hydrogen bomb works.
So why is that not classified anymore?
Well, because the Russians started leaking it, and then it was, even before the Internet, you had leaks, and basically it leaked out.
So that means Iran has it?
I'm afraid so.
Tim is actually...
You can actually look it up on Wikipedia now.
Well, I'd probably then
So you can have a force in empty space due to just light itself without any electric and magnetic charges, and that... apparently, according to Sakharov, is what gravity is. It's radiation pressure of electromagnetism.
But that's not confirmed, is it?
Well, we can see a very tiny force between, gravity is a very tiny force, and we see if we put two parallel plates together, there's a very tiny force which pushes them together, apparently due to the waves of the zero-point fluctuation of Einstein in the vacuum. So it creates a very tiny force, but so is gravity. So you can kind of make the argument, and Sakharov did, that if you have two particles, you have slightly more radiation. Let's see, put it this way. If you put two bright objects in a dark box, they repel each other due to radiation pressure. The light from one will shine on the other, and they push each other. The pressure pushes them apart. If you put two dark objects in a bright box, heat the box white hot, and have two dark objects in there, they will actually be attracted to each other with a 1 over r squared force, like gravity, because of mutual shadowing. There's slightly less pressure on the side of the particles that face each other than there is on the sides that are opposite. So the increased radiation pressure actually pushes them together, like gravity. This was discovered by Sakharov, or argued by Sakharov. And so you can actually develop an analog to gravity from electromagnetic theory. And this was part of what I have done with the end result that... you can calculate the gravitation constant from this.
Tim is actually listening to the show, so I guess we're not going to take a break. You're going to be long-winded today. he sent in a question for you. Why do neutrons decay by themselves with a half-life of 10 minutes but are stable in atomic nuclei?
That's nuclear physics, which is a little bit of a witch's brew. The problem with nuclear physics is the strong force is not very well understood. It's not as well understood as electromagnetism, for instance. So the fact that the neutrons basically carry the glue, the nuclear glue, the strong force that keeps the protons all sitting in the nucleus, the protons are all positively charged. And because they're positively charged, they repel each other. The nucleus of the atom should explode. In fact, when it splits, that's what it does. That's why you get, part of why you get so much energy out of a splitting the atom is the different parts of it are positively charged and they repel each other and they fly apart. It's also due to the strong force itself. Turning from attraction to repulsion. But the neutrons carry with them the pions, and of course inside them there are quarks and gluons and stuff, but all we see outside are the pions, pi mesons, that jump between the proton and the neutron. In fact, they kind of change the neutron from a proton to an electron. The proton is absolutely stable, so it's almost as if when the proton is there beside the neutron, it's sharing its stability. In the nucleus, the neutrons and the protons are effectively changing their identities. So the neutron in the nucleus spends time as a neutron, a proton, and vice versa. However, if you take the neutron out of the nucleus, then in 10 minutes, it doesn't have any, there's nothing to share its stability with. It needs the proton. And without the proton being there to kind of swap identities, it blows up. And it blows up into hydrogen. An electron, a proton, and a neutrino. Yes. So there's a quick explanation.
I guess so, yeah.
But here is the thing, is the you can actually start writing down the equations of gravity fields, at least in the weak gravity cases, as kind of a form of electromagnetism, light, the pressure of light, and from this zero-point fluctuation. And that's where I began working. As it turns out, if you just look at gravity and electromagnetism, it turns out there's an effect in plasma physics, which is what I work on. I worked on fusion energy, and when that money for that dried up, I went into space, because that's where all good plasma physicists go, and they work on ion thrusters and stars and prominences and things like that, astrophysical phenomena, because plasma is the natural state out in the cosmos. So it turns out in plasma physics there's an effect called E cross B drift. You can look it up on the net. Well known, very well known to plasma physicists, but hardly anyone else knows about it. If you put an electron or a proton or any charged particle in a combination of electric and magnetic fields that are crossed to each other at right angles, they will begin to drift all at the same speed, all in the same direction. It affects every charged particle the same. And they drift at right angles to both the electric and the magnetic field. So you can actually, if you have two plates, you could put a proton, an electron, a charged zinc atom, anything you want in there. They will all, everything will begin to move the same way at the same rate. And this looks like gravity. Then if you tilt the plates so the electric field is stronger at one end of the plates, because the plates are closer together at the bottom than they are at the top, and put the proton, electron, charged zinc, all of the charged particles will not only move in the same direction at the same speed, they'll speed up. They'll accelerate just like gravity. And that was the big conceptual breakthrough I got that started the GEM theory, is that you can make an effect using pure electromagnetism that looks just like gravity.
So why is it so difficult to accept that?
People are specialists. And people who work on the Standard Model generally don't like to work on gravity. They consider gravity annoying because it can't be quantized. People who work on gravity tend to just concentrate on gravity. It's simple. You've got these beautiful equations of Einstein. And as long as you leave electromagnetism and quantum mechanics out, everything is fine. So the two sides don't talk to each other. It's rare. There's only a small group of people like me who are actually working on trying to bring gravity and electromagnetism together. And since Einstein tried to do it and failed, people consider it impossible. The secret is, Einstein did not like quantum mechanics. If you allow quantum mechanics to enter, then you can get it to work. So that's what I've done.
I was going to ask you the consequences of bringing the two together. What happens if you have explained gravity this way?
As it turns out, space-time, which we just considered kind of like the fabric, a fabric of space-time that curves to make gravity.
Right.
It is electromagnetic itself. The fabric of space-time is microscopic electric and magnetic fields. And in a gravity field, they organize together, kind of like in a crystal, to make this pattern of electric and magnetic fields that actually push all of the charged particles in one direction and accelerate them. In the standard model, by the way, every particle that is stable is charged. All of the fundamental particles in the standard model, the quarks, which make up the neutrons, they're all charged. There are no uncharged particles that have mass. So you can come up with a theory that says that space-time has these hidden dimensions in it, and they make little patterns of electric and magnetic fields that are very strong. They're very tiny but very strong, and what happens is the vacuum itself is electromagnetism because of the Einstein zero-point fluctuation. This was, by the way, the idea of Sakharov. If you add the fact that you have to have a hidden dimension, this means space-time is like a honeycomb. It's full of little hidden dimensional structures. Turns out nothing. Dave, take my word for it. Nothing is very complicated in physics. It's got scandals. It's got cover-ups. It's got innuendo. Turns out, imagine space-time as like a honeycomb of hidden dimensional structures that are out there. They're very tiny, and they're full. Each hidden dimension area is full of electromagnetism, powerful electric and magnetic fields that are crossed against each, that are in opposite, they're at crossed angles, at right angles to each other. And this is what causes gravity. So, what is the upshot of this, the bottom line of this? If you introduce new, very intense electromagnetic fields into the vacuum, you can change space-time. In fact, that's what nature does. Around the proton, there are very powerful electric fields. That changes space-time so that space-time is curved around the proton and gives it mass. The same with the electron. So, we have the possibility that since space-time is electromagnetic and gravity is the curvature of space-time, we can fire electromagnetic energy into space and change its curvature directly because we're changing the fabric of space-time itself. And that is why you can fire a bunch of microwaves into a cone, and instead of getting nothing, but, you know, like a microwave oven, the thing's going to get hot.
Uh-huh.
Instead of getting nothing, it's pulling in one direction. And people say, well, how come if it's like a rocket, how is that? I said, because you're creating a curvature of space. You're changing the structure of the electromagnetic structure of space-time is being changed by our own electromagnetism, and it's creating a curvature, effectively a gravity force that is pulling on the cone. Even though if you just have a theory with electromagnetism, you get nothing. But if you combine electricity and magnetism with gravity so that space-time itself is electromagnetic, then you can change the space-time structure by electromagnetism. You can get
the M thruster effect. And so this is a revolutionary idea, and we're working with the experimental results to try and understand them. We think we understand them. I'll be presenting a paper on that on the space at the space conference.
How hard is it to do the experiments to put electromagnetism into space?
It's not that hard. Believe it or not, one of the great breakthroughs in science was the invention of the microwave oven, because anyone who wants very powerful electromagnetic fields at high frequency can tear apart a microwave oven, and it's got a radar tube, and instead of heating coffee, you can change the structure of space-time with it. So it's a flying microwave oven is what it is.
So why isn't it done? Why didn't somebody try it?
Oh, well, people have tried it, and it works. The Chinese have tried it. The British have tried it. A guy named Scheer. Scheer's problem is he tried to prove that this was happening just because of electromagnetism. And everybody knows, including me, that if you fire a bunch of microwaves into a box, like a microwave oven, nothing's going to happen. It's not going to move. It's only because you affect the structure of space-time that you make a gravitational effect that pulls it, that creates the push. So you're actually achieving gem unification in these experiments. And Scheer didn't understand that. The people at Houston, they understand that. They have their own model. So I'm working with them. I mean, you know, we're swapping emails, basically.
So
they send me data, and I look at their data, and I try to explain it.
So you're in contact with Eagle
yep.
Works?
Yeah, it's not a, it's certainly no contractual arrangement, but we're collaborating long distance.
Do you get into the warp drive from Albuquerque?
Let's say the people at Houston are making anti-gravity. That's the bending of space-time. You're bending something.
Right.
To twist it into a pretzel, that's Albuquerque drive. That's high art. If you can make anti-gravity with electromagnetism, you're bending space-time. To twist it into a pretzel, that's warp drive. That's the end limit. Obviously, it's going to require much more intense electromagnetic fields to do that, in my theory. But my theory says that you can change the curvature of space-time directly with electromagnetism, and that's what they're doing. It also says, by extension, that you can make warp drive. You can change the curvature of space around an object so that the rest of the universe treats it as if it's not there anymore.
So what is the practical end result of this if it were, you know,
verified? If we can take the results they're getting in Houston and scale them up, which my theory says we can do, then we can put up a big solar panel and have a spaceship that will get us to Mars in a month.
Why do you need a big solar panel?
You need power.
Okay.
I mean, you need a megawatt of microwaves. But we can generate that easy.
Does the solar panel travel with
it? The solar panel.
Does it travel with you?
Oh, yeah. The solar panel travels with you. It generates about 2 megawatts near the Earth, and then out by Mars it only generates a megawatt, but it gets you there.
So you're really
in a month.
You're really talking about a solar array.
We're talking about a solar array, yes.
Yeah. And how big is this solar array?
Well, about as big as the ones on the space station.
Really?
Yeah. Since we built the space station, they have solar arrays that we could now put up solar arrays that are much, almost double the efficiency. They generate about 0.5 megawatt in full sunlight on the space station.
So,
and, of course, they go behind the Earth, and it's in darkness, and it doesn't generate any power. So the, the duty cycle is about a quarter megawatt.
So help us to understand the timeline for this. So what it has to be verified.
It has to be verified.
And what do you
They're verifying it down at Houston. It works.
So is Houston able to, say, at some point issue a publish a paper that says guaranteed 100% this is it?
Yep.
Really?
At some point they're getting more and more data. Their data agrees with the Chinese data and the British data. I mean, heaven help us if we have a country that says, oh, this is physically impossible, therefore we're not even going to explore it. And the Chinese, because just like the Russians, before Sputnik, you know, people said, you can't put stuff into orbit. That's just a mathematical solution. And then the Russians did it. Because Americans were too slow. Too slow and too cautious.
So wouldn't there...
We're not supposed to be the slow, cautious country. We're supposed to be the bold, quick country.
Yeah, well, where did that go? wouldn't it be more advantageous if others were working on it other than Eagle Works in Houston?
Oh, yes. I'm going to be... you know, with whatever authority I can, since I've published these theories saying that we're actually doing a gem unification, I'm going to try and get a congressman. In fact, I'm going to invite a congressman to send his aides to my paper in Long Beach.
Good luck.
Well,
so if
some local congressman in Long Beach is a big aerospace area.
That's right. So your book, which I promoted for this show, which we really haven't talked about, the GEM unification theory, extending the standard model to include gravitation. Is this your presentation at Space 2016?
I'll be basically talking about applying it to the QV thruster. I didn't talk about that, you know, as an application in the book. It was mostly astrophysics.
What is the QV thruster?
The QV thruster means quantum vacuum thruster.
Okay.
That's Houston's name for what they're doing. We have to get them more money. We have to get other people to start working on the same thing and reproduce the results.
Are they going to be at AIAA?
I believe so.
So Sunny.
And there's another meeting in about a week in Colorado where I'll be meeting with the QV thruster people.
So Sunny White, do you think is going to be at AIAA?
I'm not sure. One of his team.
So the interesting thing is, about 3 or 4 years ago, Sonny was on the show.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, and he was on with my Breakthrough Propulsion guys, and I'm having a senior moment. Crap. Mark.
Mark Millis?
Yeah, and Mark Millison or whatever his name was.
Yeah, Millis.
Millis, and then his partner that wrote that really great AIAA book and starts with an E. I'm having a blank on that, too.
That's all right.
And so he was on. So I started trying to get...
Eric Davis.
Eric Davis, yeah.
So, yeah, Eric Davis, brilliant guy.
Brilliant guy. And so I've been...
By the way, he's very much into the same Sakharov interpretation of space-time as electromagnetic.
Well,
like
I should probably see if Eric will come on. But I've been trying to get Sonny to come back on. So Sonny turned it over to a year ago to JSCPR, okay, public relations.
Right.
So here comes the dance for about 4 months. And then they quit responding to me completely. And Sonny quit responding. So the word on the street is that they've got the kibosh on public relations because this is so far out there and so controversial.
It is controversial.
And so subject to so much criticism that they have really curtailed the publication. So about 2 months ago, I did a show with a British scientist on M-Drive.
Yeah.
And he said, he didn't really talk about it the way you are, but he said that everybody is waiting because the word is that the Eagle Works guys are about to produce a peer-reviewed paper that says there really is something to M drive and this is a real effect and on and on and on. And if that is true and they produce that kind of reviewed paper, it's going to open up the research funding and everything else, because finally it will be taken seriously and be taken out of the crackpot world. So
well,
a lot is waiting on that.
The work they're doing is really good.
Yeah, and they see said a lot is pending and waiting on what's going to come out of Eagle Works on M Drive. Now, he didn't really talk about Alky Berry Drive, but he was specifically focused on
farther down the road,
on M Drive. So if they are publishing a paper for AIAA, maybe that's what he was referring to. I don't know.
I'll have to check and see if they have any papers there. But you know,
Who with the team, or can you say who you're in touch with?
I'd rather not. Let's just say. You know, I'm in touch with a member of their team, and you know, I've been there and talked about my own theory to them, and so we maintain a correspondence. It's you know, it's kind of casual. It's not a I wouldn't call it a collaboration, but they're certainly sharing data with me, and what I'm trying to do is use my theory to increase their thrust per unit of power, which is good now. It's good enough to get you a couple ton space, you know, 10 ton spaceship to Mars with a big solar panel in a month.
So let me ask you.
We scaled it up.
Let me ask you another question. This is kind of out of left field. Let's make the assumption that this is real and that there's a commercial scaling up potential here.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is what my theory indicates.
Okay. So what does this do to existing commercial chemical rocket companies? Does this turn them on end? Does this squander their resources they're spending, like building a Falcon Heavy or building SLS for the government?
Well, the forces we can generate with this are much smaller. If you're going to get into orbit, you need a big chemical rocket right now.
But yet you're saying you can get to Mars
locks
in a month.
And the first part of your journey to Mars is LOX and kerosene, and that's the way it's going to be
for
a long time.
So you're not...
Once you're in low Earth orbit, though, getting the rest of the way to Mars and thrusting continuously all the way to Mars, then you use the QV thruster or the M drive.
So what you're saying is that no matter whether this is real or not, the chemical rocket is here to stay for a long time to come.
Absolutely.
You can't launch from Earth with this.
No, not yet. Simply because the forces that you can generate with this effect are quite small right now. It's like ion thrusters. Ion thrusters work really well now, but you can only use them in space. You can't go into orbit with them. You need LOX and kerosene.
What does this do to the advocates of nuclear propulsion?
It makes them nervous.
and
it makes them nervous because this says instead of putting up a big nuclear power station in orbit and turning it on... just put up a big solar panel and go to Mars with just solar electric thrust.
So I would assume this would be far less controversial than nuclear power.
Much, much less controversial, yes. Hence their nervousness. Because we already know we can build a nuclear rocket. It's just a matter of
political
will to put one into orbit and turn it on.
Yes, political policy completely.
Yes, and the environmental impact statements and you got to remember going to Mars, sending people to Mars, that's already a little controversial. If you add another layer of controversy on it, it may be a deal killer. So the first people to go to Mars will probably go there by chemical or solar electric. Ion thrusters of some sort, if this can get on a fast track, the QV thruster, which uses no propellant.
How big a spaceship could you make using a QV thruster? Could you get Musk, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people to Mars like he talks about?
I believe so, yes. It all scales. I mean, it takes a bigger and bigger. You need a much bigger solar panel to move. For every ton of spacecraft you want to move, you're going to need that much more square area of solar panels. So it's a using solar panels as big as on the space station, if my theory is correct, we can move, you know, three people to Mars in a month.
So this all happens, so let me see if me as the layman here can get this correct.
Sure.
Because you are merging together, in an effect, gravity and electromagnetism.
Right. We are unifying gravity and electromagnetism. Gravity is, of course, the curvature of space-time. So we are saying that space-time itself, its fabric, is electromagnetic. Therefore, we can change its structure using electromagnetism. Once you make that breakthrough.
Do you need new physics to do this? Because how do you violate...
Yes, new physics.
So you're
absolutely new physics.
How do you violate conservation of momentum?
Ah, where is the reaction force? If you're pushing, developing this push, what is receiving the push? When you fire a chemical rocket, LOX kerosene?
Right.
Obviously, the rocket is moving forward and the exhaust is moving backwards.
Right.
There's the action and reaction pair.
Absolutely.
Newton's third law of motion.
Where is
Newton's third law here? The Earth, because it determines the structure of space-time, the sun, the moon, things that are determining the local structure of space-time, they receive the push. This is just like when starlight comes by the sun, it's slightly bent because of the gravity of the sun. Where's the reaction force there? The momentum of the light is actually changed, and the sun is actually attracted slightly to the ray of light as the ray of light is bent. So it actually goes through space-time. One of the problems or mysteries about gravity theory as it is right now is it's difficult to figure out where the momentum and energy transfers through space-time. If you have two stars orbiting each other, they're obviously exchanging gravity. They're obviously exchanging energy and momentum. Alpha Centauri is two stars about the size of the sun. They orbit each other about the same radius of orbit as Saturn orbiting the sun. So you have these two stars chasing each other. Where does the momentum and energy transfer occur that makes one star reverse its direction and start heading in the other direction just as simultaneously the other star reverses direction? And that is very difficult to figure out in general relativity. So because there is no what's called momentum, a gravitational momentum, is very difficult to isolate theoretically. People can't come up with a consistent theory of it. But the short answer is, what is the reaction force? The reaction is on the Earth itself. You're pushing. Think of the space-time structure around the Earth as part of the Earth itself. Here you got the Earth, and then you got this curvature of space-time. When the QV thruster is turned on, it's bending that space, goes back against the Earth itself.
But as you go further and further out and closer to Mars, are you still, Earth still receiving it?
You leave the sphere of influence gravitationally of the Earth, you're finally the sun. Just like the orbit is no longer curving because of the Earth, it's curving because of the sun as you get out near Mars. you're crossing interplanetary space. The curved orbit, the Holman transfer kind of orbit, is curved because of the sun's influence, not the Earth's. And so the reaction is against the sun's gravity field. The gravity field of the sun is taking the reaction force.
So you really don't have new physics then?
Not. It's new. It's the key idea is that space-time is electromagnetic. Therefore, we can change the structure of space-time, creating gravity-type forces with electromagnetism. That's new. But the fact that when you bend a spacecraft goes to Mars and its path bends, the reaction force of that bending is the sun itself. The sun is being attracted to the spacecraft as the spacecraft is being attracted to the sun, and the two react against each other. And that happens in conventional and general relativity gravity theory already. We're doing this now with pure electromagnetism, so that effect is actually already in general relativity. Bending starlight, shine a big laser beam past the sun, it bends slightly because of the sun's gravity. The sun itself feels a reaction force to that bending laser beam. So in a sense, when we're doing a QB thruster, we're firing a bunch of electromagnetic energy into a cone. The cone, by the way, makes the electric field cluster at one end and the magnetic field cluster at the other. It distorts it, and that distorts space-time. The Earth and the sun feel the reaction.
So if you went out to Pluto, would you still be getting the reaction from the sun?
Oh, there is a very good question. Would your reaction force, would you have, just like an airplane that can't fly much higher than, 100,000 feet because there's just not enough air to generate aerodynamic forces?
Right, or lift, yeah.
Yeah, in my theory, by the way, this comes out to be a vacuum Bernoulli equation, similar to the Bernoulli equation of flight. Yes, if you're out by Pluto, you've got to invent something new because there's less and less gravity to kind of push against. You're pushing against the gravity of the Earth. But as the gravity goes away, so goes your force. That's an excellent point. So, you can't probably use this to travel to Alpha Centauri, at least not in the present form that it's in. You have to think of something better. You have to improve it. Well, you need warp drive, basically.
So for interstellar travel, this is probably not applicable.
Probably not. Not in present form of the theory. Like I said, warp drive, anti-gravity, QV thruster drive, M drive is bending space-time with electromagnetism directly. Warp drive is twisting it into a pretzel with electromagnetism, and that requires far more electromagnetic energy, in my theory, much more intense, stronger fields than we can really generate right now. And so that's the basic theory. That's why the QB thruster and the M drive is working. Is we're bending space-time with electromagnetism directly through a GEM unification, gravity E&M unification. I'll also mention, by the way, that because of the existence of hydrogen, it turns out the key parameter in the theory is the number 42.8503. It's a number like pi. It goes on forever. And it turns out the number 42.85 falls out of every place. It's the quickest place to see it is it's the square root of the ratio of the electron to the proton mass. And so just like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the answer to the whole question of the universe, the meaning of life and everything is the number 42.85. That's the gem number. What's also amazing, and which I found in as I published in this book and also an online scientific article, which people can download, I sent it the link to you, Dave, is the fact that hydrogen was born in the universe, that the hidden dimensional structure of the universe makes it predisposed to make hydrogen. Turns out a hidden dimension looks like a subatomic particle. If you say, here's the hidden dimension, okay, I shine a light on it, what does it look like? If I fire x-rays and try to look at a hidden dimension to see it on x-rays or something, what does it look like? It looks like a subatomic particle. It looks like an electron or a proton in isolation. And as it turns out, because if you shine a light through a chamber that has a perfect vacuum except for one electron, you can actually see the electron as a little spark when you shine a light through it. This is called Thomson scattering. They use it in plasma physics all the time. So you can actually see a single electron, and it looks like a little teeny BB, a little teeny sphere, a bead covered with silver, floating there in the vacuum. That's what an electron looks like. It looks like a little teeny tiny Christmas ornament. And the proton, if you shine a light, or if you shine neutrons, interestingly enough, the proton is almost exactly the same size as the electron, because the neutrons bounce off of this little teeny sphere in the vacuum. And as it turns out, the mathematics predicts these sizes, but people have never taken them that seriously. They say, well, the mathematics gives you this size. We don't really believe there actually has a size. The electron has a size. It's just a point, mathematical point. But if you do the equations, you get this size. It has a diameter as if it was a little silver bead. As it turns out, in this theory, those surfaces actually resonate. They act as if they're real surfaces. This is quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, Schrodinger's cat is neither alive nor dead and even can catch mice. You say to this cat, hey, you're dead. And the cat has caught a mouse and is bringing it to you alive to play with it in front of you to show what a good cat it is. Technically, this cat should not exist outside the little box it's in.
Right.
But because of quantum mechanics, not only does it exist, it has visible effects. Schrodinger's cat can actually not only be alive but catch mice. And so, as it turns out, the vibrations of these little surfaces of these particles create the strong and the weak force. And it turns out the if you ratio the mass of the pion to the W particle, which is the charged pion to the charged W particle, which is the weak force carrier versus the strong force carrier, it turns out to be this number 42 to the third power. Exactly.
I have another question for you, if you can
say. Sure.
I was hoping Tim would call in, but I guess he can't do it. So Tim,
maybe he's got laryngitis.
I don't know. Maybe he's got he sometimes has a really bad
maybe
phone
line. Maybe Schrodinger's cat has got his tongue.
I don't think sometimes he has a really bad phone line. So here you're talking about really advanced stuff, and we still have crappy phone lines in this country.
I know.
It's just you maybe ought to do something practical for humanity here.
Well, I'm trying to.
Give us better phones.
Nuclear power in safe ways.
How about giving us multiple duplex for cell phones instead of single duplex, instead of no duplex. So, okay, anyway, Tim says, since the M drive needs a gravitational field to work, does that mean that M drive would work better if it does a close flyby of the sun? If an M drive powered spacecraft dips within Mercury's orbit, what would be the max velocity?
I haven't done that calculation, but he has a good point. If the M drive is basically allowing us to push against the gravity field of the Earth as if it's a solid thing.
Uh-huh.
That's one way that you can think of the M drive. The M drive is, what is it pushing against? It's pushing against the gravity field of the Earth. And so, yes, as you get away from the Earth, you get less push. Then the gravity of the sun takes over. And, yes, if you want to take maximum advantage of this effect, you basically have to have strong gravity to push against. Just like an airplane needs, you know, can't fly into space because it needs air to generate aerodynamic force. We're basically generating a gem dynamic force against the gravity field of the Earth in the theory that I have developed. And this gives you your push. So, yes, you getting by the orbit of Mercury. Well, look at how we did the Voyager tour of the planets. We used Jupiter as a gravity assist. We used the fact that we could get into the intense field of gravity around Jupiter. So, in a sense, we're kind of extending that idea. We're taking advantage of an intense gravity field to generate a force by pushing against the gravity field itself. So, yeah, to get to Alpha Centauri, that's going to take a little bit more work. That problem is left for the students.
Will we be replacing you down the road, right?
Someday, yes, when my ashes are interned on Mars.
Well, you're committed to that. We'll have a memorial erected there somehow, the Brandenburg crater or something.
Well, I do hope you outlive me, yes, and can administer this this funeral service on Mars.
Well, you need to put it in your will. Not I don't know how that will play out, but
I'll tell you the bottom line is I've been working on this gem theory for a long time. I can explain, I believe, the QV thruster results as a gem effect, literally, and the reason that no one can understand it is because they don't, you have to accept the idea that gravity and E&M can be unified in order to explain it. But the gem theory has now pushed on and actually predicts the masses of the pion, the masses of the W and Z particles, which carry the strong and the weak force. They just fell out of the theory. And as it turns out, if you take the ratio of the mass of the W particle and the mass of the charged pion, those are the two charged particles that carry the forces, and take the ratio of that, it's the quantum mechanical fine structure constant times this magic number 42.85, which is the number which unifies gravity and E&M. The same number unifies the strong and the weak forces too. So I got the whole thing coast to coast in a very rudimentary form, I will say. Very rudimentary. I call this the Bohr model of unification. But for the first time in history, we have a theory that gives the gravitation constant, the proton mass to parts per thousand, plus the masses of the weak force carrier, the W and Z particles, plus the carriers of the pion, the pi mesons. It gives all of those masses in one theory, and that is now published. And that's the first time in history it's done it. Other people who are far more sophisticated in, like, the standard model, they will hopefully be able to build on this to create a wall-to-wall, complete unified field theory. I've just basically landed on the beach, put up the flag of Spain and the crucifix, and claimed the whole place. So that's what I'm basically publishing now.
Well, I'm waiting for
I'm just calling it, by the way, unify gravity with the standard model, it's called a super unified theory. Now, the super unified theory, because it now puts out the WZ particles and the pi mesons, it's a wall-to-wall unification now. It also predicts the Higgs boson mass. I did that 4 months before it was known. So I'm pretty happy at this point.
Are people trying to shoot it down?
Once they see it bop, once they start paying attention to it, they will try and shoot it down, yes.
I mean, that's part of science, I assume.
Part of science is the guy who discovered the galaxies, the Andromeda galaxy was a galaxy, was Hubble, and it got down, so it was deeply personal. One guy was writing letters to other astronomers and saying, not only is Hubble wrong, but nobody likes him. And his mother wears army boots. Science is a very human activity. It's full of human passions. People who are really passionate about their work in science, like me, will start taking pot shots at my theory as soon as they're aware of it.
Well, you've been talking about it for years, and you've been certainly three or four space shows on it already.
By the way, everyone is starting to use the term gem now.
Well,
I'm the first person to use it.
Well, you should have a footnote next to it.
I should have it copyrighted. Trademarked.
Absolutely, you should have T-shirts made. Gem is my idea.
This is my idea. Well, I do. I have a very big record of publication now, and if you do gem theory, it pops up Brandenburg.
But
gem unification theory pops up Brandenburg.
You should
and a few other little small fry who are trying to call their works gems.
You should go to one of these T-shirt companies for AIAA and say Gem Theory by Dr. John Platt and have a T-shirt to wear.
I'm probably going to do that.
You know, and then, have hats made. So
there will be wet T-shirt contests using the Gem Theory T-shirts. That would be the ultimate compliment to my theory. But I digress.
Yeah, you do.
So anyway, for the first time in history, we have a theory that says gravitation constant, the proton mass, which is the source of all gravity, to parts per thousand, plus to parts per thousand also the masses of the pi mesons and the W and Z particles, which carry the weak force and the strong force, all in one theory. And that's, by the way, in the online journal article that I have a link to. So when they first invented quantum mechanics, the first great triumph of quantum mechanics was the Bohr model of the hydrogen atom. It's the simplest atom. It's just a positive charge and an electron rotating around it. But hydrogen, you can make hydrogen really easy and put it in a neon sign tube, which is what they did, light it up with electricity. And it puts out this beautiful spectra of discrete lines. It's called a line spectrum. And what Bohr did is he showed that if you quantized the electrons in their orbits, if you said the electrons are orbiting around the proton like planets orbit the sun, only their orbits are quantized with Planck's constant of quantization, then you can explain the wavelengths of the light that you see in those spectra. And it did it very precisely. So, as it turns out, the electrons don't move like planets around the sun. They're kind of ball, it's a ball of fuzz. There's the proton, and then the electron is just kind of like a ball of cotton around it. So that part was not right about the Bohr model, but it did give the right numbers, and it made believers out of everybody. So what I'm saying is that my GEMS theory, GEMS superunification theory, is a Bohr model of unification. It's a Bohr model. It's rudimentary. It's simple. But it gives the right numbers. And later it will be replaced by much more sophisticated understandings. But, yes. But ask me, Dave, ask me if I'm pleased that the pi mesons and the W and Z particle fell out of this theory.
I think you are pleased from the sound of things.
Yes, I am very pleased. My intention was just to go to Mars quickly and conveniently by unifying gravity and E&M, the two long-range forces.
Uh-huh.
Turns out in the two short-range forces, as it turns out, when hydrogen was born in the universe, the strong and the weak force were born with it that make the universe run, that makes the stars, you know, fusion energy reactions and radioactive decay. The whole universe's dynamics were born with hydrogen and gravity and E&M. Isn't that something?
So we're going to wind down the show. You're almost at a,
sure,
at a two-hour show. Did I miss anything? Is there something more you wanted to say?
No, no. You know, my original intention was just to get to Mars. But I ended up the pi mesons and the W and Z particles. I want to invent anti-gravity by, you know, pursuing. Here's the basic thing. Einstein was right. He didn't like quantum mechanics, so this basically he tied one arm behind his back and tried to solve the unification problem. If he just embraced quantum mechanics, he could have found it. It was right in front of him. So Einstein was right in his lifelong final quest to unify gravity and electromagnetism, and to do that with the idea of hydrogen, that the universe is dominated by hydrogen, therefore space-time favors the production of hydrogen and stability of its constituents. That's the bottom line. Einstein was right. Gravity and E&M can be unified, and that GEM unification explains why the QB thruster works. What also happened, as it turns out, when hydrogen was born, and this means Einstein was very close to a full unification of the four forces of nature, the E&M, gravity, the long-range forces, the short-range forces, the weak and the strong, which run the nucleus, and which create starlight and sunlight, meaning the universe can be full of life and elements. That falls out of a theory that unifies gravity, E&M, and explains hydrogen. So that's the bottom line. The vibrations of the mathematical surfaces of the proton and electron create the strong and the weak force and give precise numbers as to the masses of the quanta that carry those forces. So, and this has happened for the first time in history. For the first time, someone has published this. It also says that Einstein was very close to a full unification like this when he died in 1955.
Too bad.
Too bad.
Too bad.
He was such a smart guy. And so, anyway. Oh, but by the way, Einstein was ridiculed himself for wanting to do this.
Uh-huh.
He says Oppenheimer was his boss at the Institute for Advanced Study, and he just says, Einstein's lost it. That's what he said. He said Einstein's lost it. He should be working on nuclear, you know, quantum stuff like us, building atomic bombs. Oppenheimer didn't say that, actually. He was very sad about the atomic bomb. But everybody was working on quantum mechanics and nuclear physics and finally quarks and things like that by the time Einstein died. And Einstein was still working away on this E&M gravity thing. And, you know, so Oppenheimer was asked to comment on Einstein's work at the Institute for Advanced Studies and, you know, basically criticized him, as gave him a poor employee evaluation, saying, Einstein is cuckoo, and he keeps talking about this E&M gravity thing, and nobody's interested in it. So, but it turns out, as usual, I mean, Einstein invented the theory of the laser, the zero-point fluctuation. He got Kaluza-Klein stuff published. E equals MC squared. He was right about so many things. He was actually right about this, too. But he just, because he thought that God wouldn't play dice, he couldn't understand how kind of sort of impossible things could happen. And
timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
And location.
That's right. I'll look forward to seeing you at Long Beach.
I'll look forward to riding to Mars with you, Dave.
Well, I don't care.
Not for my own funeral, though.
I don't care that much about going to Mars, and I'd probably be claustrophobic.
I do. I want to get off this crazy planet as quickly as possible.
Well, after the election, I may want to go more, so we'll see how things turn out. But I may be ready to take the risk on a Mars one-way mission. So that's how desperate things may become after November of this year.
I know. Well,
you know, it's just too bad the candidates don't go on a Mars One mission. That would be the best of all worlds. We could put them on it, and then we could, since I assume that we'll never see them again, we could then get different candidates.
Well, we should live in a truly rational country like France, you know?
Oh, yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Where everything runs smoothly.
Absolutely. I don't know. Somebody's probably having
Somebody asked me if the British were right to leave the common market, and I said, well, you know, Britain is the most intelligently governed country in Europe, traditionally. I mean, it's the only major country in Europe that never tried to invade Russia. You know, unlike Napoleon
and the other people, yeah.
Yeah, the Swedes tried to invade Russia, it turns out. That's how Peter got to be Peter the Great.
All right, my friend. your book is available.
See you on Mars, Dave.
And your book, people can get it on Amazon, I'm assuming?
That's right. And I'm going to be published. It's a book written for other scientists, so it's full of equations and... you know, the models are simple, but, you know, it's got a lot of calculus and other equations in it. And so I'm going to write a guide that will be posted on my website, lifeonmars.pub. And it'll be, you know, so you can go through the chapters and understand what I'm talking about in lay terms.
So it's lifeonmars.com?
Lifeonmars.pub. Just think of an English pub.
Okay.
So that's I'll be posting a a layman's guide to the work of you know, the gem unification theory, extending the standard model to include gravitation, and it's got a nice cover of the Pleiades, and it is historic. No one has ever done this before.
Well, we look forward to hearing a lot more about it. So,
well, we actually, in the book and in the article that I gave you a link to, it actually predicts new phenomena. One of the phenomena it predicts is that empty space. If you stare at a cubic yard of vacuum for a billion years, once a billion years, you will see a little spark, and out will fly from empty space, a plus charge, a proton, and an electric, a negative charge, that's an electron, hydrogen, will appear out of empty space. This is called vacuum decay. And it has been predicted by other people if there is a hidden dimension that it will cause quantum mechanically an instability of space. Space itself is slightly radioactive, as it turns out. It's because it's got a lot of stuff going on there. And the other thing that predicts is that when two black holes collide, it makes gravity waves. It'll also make a flash of gamma rays, and they may have already seen that. They found the first burst of gravity waves from two titanic black holes colliding.
Right.
May have created a flash of gamma rays. And this means because space is absolutely stripped bare around the black holes, all the matter gets swept into the black holes. This means empty space itself is creating matter and gamma rays from bare vacuum, just because the gravity stress is so great when the two black holes collide. So they may have seen signs of that, and of course they're now looking, they're actually looking now for these flashes. And I predicted these, by the way, back, based on the GEM theory, back in 2003 or 4. It's called the Consolago-Brandenburg hypothesis. Barham Consolago was a collaborator with Einstein on the unified field theory, and he liked my work. So we briefly collaborated just before he died, and we produced this hypothesis that when black holes collide, you get a blast of gamma rays as well as gravity waves. So they may have seen that. I also predict a new particle will be found at 22 MeV. This is very light. It's only about 42 times heavier than the electron. And it'll be very difficult to see, but if you have an intense enough beam of electrons shining or colliding with itself, you'll see evidence that there is this new particle. And the new particle is the hidden dimension particle. It's the particle, it's the hidden dimension, basically, seen as a particle, and people will be able to see it, or at least indirect evidence of it as it decays in the gamma rays. It'll probably decay in the gamma rays as quickly as it forms, but it's you'll see it in experiments. So I predict that. So I'm going to try and get people interested. There's an accelerator facility called the Continuous Electron Beam a facility called CBAF in Virginia. They have one of the brightest, you know, a very intense beam of electrons, and they use it to do nuclear physics, and I'm going to try and see if they'll actually arrange an experiment to see if they can see this, what I call the M-star particle, or morning star particle, named after the consulting group I work for that funded this research. It's called Morningstar Applied Physics.
Well, let us know. That'll be another program.
Oh, sure, sure. You'll hear about that one.
All right. Listen, we gotta go. And
Dave, always a pleasure to be on your show.
Likewise.
And we're going to Mars.
Okay. Sign everyone up.
It locks hydrogen first time, but later we'll go with GEM.
Sign everyone up.
I sure will.
Bring a sign-up sheet with you to AIAA.
And I will go there. I'll be standing there in a spacesuit on Mars someday, and not as ashes.
All right.
Ashes, that comes later.
We'll make note of that. John, thank you very much.
That will be covered by funeral insurance.
That you see on late-night TV, right?
Right.
All right. We will talk to you later, and thank you very much, and I'll get the archive information to you
okay.
As soon as it's done.
Dave, always a pleasure and honor to be on your show.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today. Everybody have a great weekend. Remember, Dick Rocket comes back on Sunday at 12 p.m. California time. Thanks again to Dr. Brandenburg and to those of you who emailed in questions. Everybody have a great weekend. Goodbye from The Space Show and John Brandenburg.